Welcome to Hidden History, Stories from the Secret City. I'm Keith McDaniel, along with my co-host, Ray Smith. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Keith.
We've got a returning guest today, so why don't you go ahead and introduce him?
Yeah, Dr. Todd Ryder is with us from the Ryder Institute. And as you know, we've had Todd on a number of times. I don't know, maybe up to four times now, I believe. And he's got a couple of more that we want to include, this one. And then in a few weeks, we're going to bring him back again for a part two of this particular Forgotten Creators series. And I want to mention, Todd, I don't know if I've told you this, but of all of the people that watch our Hidden History Stories from the Secret City video cast, of all the guests that we've had on, yours has been the most viewed. So you're our top guest, and we appreciate you for that.
Oh, wow, it's quite an honor. Well, I'd like to thank the members of the Academy, and I'd like to thank my agent.
You're just getting ready for tomorrow night, aren't you? Academy, well, when we're recording this, tomorrow is the Academy Awards. So,
all right. Well, Todd, without further ado, go ahead and bring us up to date on anything that you want to regarding your Forgotten Creators, but also we're looking forward to your presentation today.
Sure. Well, thank you both very much for inviting me back, and please jump in anytime along the way if you have any questions or suggestions. So I've given previous presentations, as you mentioned, to Hidden History and to several museums about the wartime German nuclear program and the progress toward developing nuclear weapons there. This is a presentation about the delivery methods that they were developing. So methods of delivering any potential nuclear weapons to Allied targets during the war. And this is also an updated version of what I've given previously. So a lot of new archival evidence. And so this information comes from many archives all around the world. And I'm not the only one who's found this. This is, you know, largely due to many, many people who've been digging for literally decades through these archives. So this information has been slowly declassified and rediscovered in these archives. I should also mention that everything I'll be describing here comes from purely unclassified sources, so please don't shoot me. the topic here is the nuclear triad, and we think of this as a, you know, post-World War II Cold War concept developed by the United States and the Soviet Union. The notion of the nuclear triad is that there are three different methods, independent methods, of delivering a nuclear payload when you care enough to send the very best. One of those is to have land-launched ballistic missiles. The second is to have sub-launched missiles. The third is to have intercontinental jet bombers. So obviously the U.S. and the Soviet Union have had this throughout the Cold War and since the Cold War. But what I can show from this archival evidence is that these approaches, this concept, actually originated in Germany during the war. And it's still unclear just how close to operational Germany became with all three of these elements, but they were working very, very seriously on all three methods of delivering nuclear weapons. So I want to give a brief summary of the nuclear payloads they had in mind, then today we'll discuss the land-launched intercontinental missiles, there's a lot of archival evidence on that. So that will be part one, then part two. Hopefully in the near future, we'll discuss sub-launch missiles and intercontinental jet bombers. Let me start with a brief overview of the nuclear payloads. And from the archival evidence, I've seen quite a bit of information about three different nuclear payloads, three different nuclear designs that they were very seriously working on and developing. And so you have to think about what would be required to carry these to some target. The smallest had a mass of perhaps 300 kilograms or so. It was about the standard size of a normal German 250-kilogram bomb, so relatively easy to deliver. It had a small yield, probably much less than a kiloton of explosive nuclear yield. And it appears that this was tested in 1944 and 45. So there are a number of sources talking about this. There was even a German prisoner of war who was captured and mentioned he'd actually been handling a stockpile of these weapons, and he drew a detailed diagram showing the inside and the outside, the correct details of these weapons. So that was small. Here was the medium-sized version. This was a fission bomb, actually quite similar to the U.S. Gadget or Fat Man. This was a little smaller in size. It had a mass of about 2,000 kilograms to 2 tons. Think about, delivery methods for, carrying 2 tons to a target. If used with a full load of nuclear fuel, it'd probably have a full nuclear yield of several tens of kilotons, about comparable to Gadget Fat Man, maybe even somewhat larger yield. And there are so many sources that describe this weapon and describe the progress, even describe the testing of it, that we actually have a very good idea of the specifications of this weapon. So here in the upper right, I've shown the specifications for this compared to the US version. So that was small, medium, and here is supersized. There are over 30 sources that actually describe a full-blown German H-bomb. It seems almost impossible to believe. The other countries, the US, Soviet Union, were not doing H-bombs till the 1950s. But over 30 sources from the time that describe very serious German development of a weapon with an expected megaton yield. The weapon would have a total mass of 6 tons, about 6,000 kilograms. It used both fission and lots of fusion fuel, used lithium deuteride, exactly as was developed at Oak Ridge after the war. This was apparently not tested during the war, but they expected if the war had continued, they would have tested this sometime later in 1945 or maybe 1946. So you have to think about delivery methods that could carry a 6-ton payload to targets during the war. And again, there are many, many, many sources that all describe this weapon. So now let's get into the land-launched intercontinental missiles that could carry one or more of those weapons. First up is liquid propellant missiles. Everyone is quite familiar with the German V2 rocket that was used during the war. The scientists called it the A4, the fourth out of a series of these rockets they're developing. It had a length of 14 meters. That's quite important because soon we're going to see longer versions of this. It could carry a payload of 1 ton, so it could easily carry the smallest nuclear weapon, but not the larger ones. There may have been ways to boost it up to 2 tons. They actually built over 6,000 of these during the war. Somewhat less familiar is the A9 or the A4B. This was an A4 or a V2 with wings. The wings would help to glide upon reentry instead of coming straight down. And so it gave it a longer range. Officially, from the history books, at least 10 of these were built during the war. At least two were launched. Both of those were destroyed in flight. But there are still questions about, did they perhaps get further with that? So keep these designs in mind, especially the standard A4 here with 14 meters. Then there are modified versions. So, what other researchers have found in the archives is more and more evidence that those were not the most advanced German rockets. There were more advanced German rockets. Here is one simple modification. This was found by the British researcher and author Philip Henschel. So in British archives, he found captured German blueprints showing a central compartment in the A4 or the V2. So on the left is the real blueprint. On the right is Henschel's reconstruction of what this would have looked like. This would be a compartment for potentially a much heavier payload, perhaps the 2-ton fission bomb. Further modified versions. So we know that after the war, the captured German rocket engineers in Russia and in the United States started reconstructing their V2s, their standard A4s with 14-meter length. But they also started building improved A4s with a greater length and a greater range. So in the Soviet Union, standard V2 or A4 was rebuilt as what became known as the SS1 or the R1, so 14 meter length. But by the 1950s, with the aid of all these captured German rocket engineers, the Soviet Union was building and fielding the SS2 or the R2, which was a stretched version with a length of about 18 meters. So 18 meters long let it carry more propellant, which gave it greater range. Of course, the greater propellant had greater weight, and so the engine had to be upgraded with improved thrust as well. Then by the late 50s, they were building and fielding the SS3 or the R5M with a length of 21 meters and even greater range. And Wernher von Braun and the other Germans in the United States were doing the same thing. They were building much longer versions of the A4, up to 21 meters long. And so these are what we know as the Redstone or the Mercury Redstone, the Jupiter C. But the fact that these unconnected teams of German engineers after the war were developing, extremely similar stretched A4s suggests that this was based on wartime work, at the very least wartime designs, and possibly wartime construction of stretched A4s. So here on this table, I've shown the specifications in the left column here for the standard A4, and in the right columns for these post-war versions. And then in blue, I've shown the estimated specifications for what stretched wartime versions of the A4 might have been like, and what their ranges would be. I've also shown the effect of the payload. So if you have a standard 1-ton payload, you can go a little further. These could all lift a 2-ton payload. They could lift the medium-sized nuclear bomb and have a somewhat shorter range as a result. Now, there's actually evidence that wartime Germany was seriously working on these. Here's some of the first bits of the evidence. These were engineers and writers with deep knowledge of what had been going on in Germany during the war, knowledge of the rocket programs at Peenemünde in northern Germany. And after the war, they wrote about a rocket design called the A8. So not the A4, the A8. And they mentioned that it had an upgraded thrust, upgraded engines, about twice the thrust, and that it had a greater length, so length up to 18 or 20, even 22 meters long. And so this kind of matches what we would expect for that upgraded, longer A4 rocket. So that was a design. Did they actually build it? Well, here is a wartime report. This is from U.S. intelligence. They captured a prisoner of war, interrogated this person, and found out that this person knew of German rocket production in southern Germany at a town called Friedrichshafen, very near the Swiss border. So this was 1943, and this prisoner of war said that they were making rockets there, and these rockets were so long it took three railroad cars to haul out each rocket. Now, a standard V2 or a standard A4 was designed so it could be carried on one railroad car. You might have to take the warhead off, but you could carry it on one railroad car. These were huge rockets to require three to carry them out. And it was not just one crazy guy who was telling this story, but they captured multiple prisoners of war who all had experience with the same facility at Friedrichshafen. And they all said, yes, they were building larger rockets there. Building rockets with a weight, a mass up to 25 tons, whereas the standard A4, fully fueled, only had a mass of about 14 tons, so much larger rockets. And then after the war, Allied investigators went to Friedrichshafen and other places, and they found evidence that these things were built. So here from a post-war investigative CAIUS report, they talked to people on the ground in Friedrichshafen, and the German engineers said, yes, well, during the war, we were building rockets with longer propellant tanks. But of course, we never intended to actually use those rockets. No, we were perfectly innocent. So here's one report talking to one set of people. Here's a different CAIOS investigator report talking to a different set of people. Yes, during the war, we built these longer rockets, these longer tanks, but still, you know, same story. We never launched them. We never even dreamed of launching these things. No, no. Interestingly, this report also mentions that they were contemplating a piloted, a manned version of these rockets, requiring a pilot to steer it. And apparently there were several eager volunteers trying to get on board the world's first piloted launch. Here is more evidence that these were not only built, but even launched. this is from Alan Dulles, so kind of a super spy during the war. He sent lots of reports from Europe back to D.C., and this is from 1943. So he reports successful launches of the standard A4, but he also reports that they had built versions up to 20 meters, and they had launched versions up to 20 meters long, and that, quote, they always exploded in air. Here is a similar report from a different source. This is from 1944. Reporting that in addition to the standard A4 rocket, they have launched longer versions, anywhere from 18 to 25 meters long, and that these versions often come to grief, as it says here. So there are problems associated with making these longer. And for insight into those problems, this is a post-war report by one of the Russian officials that rounded up German rocket engineers and then used them for the post-war Soviet rocket program, and says that after the war, indeed, they built longer versions of these. Until they finally figured out how to solve the problem, the longer versions, because they were longer and still used the same guidance system, it confused the guidance system. So these longer rockets had a tendency to, quote, enter an unexpected self-oscillation mode, which is not exactly what you want in your rocket. But anyway, suggests that, the Germans really were building longer rockets. And the reason we haven't seen more of them in the history books is that they were prone to these sort of difficulties. So the question is, how far did the German engineers get in solving these difficulties during the war? Here is further evidence. This is from a reporter named Charles Murphy. He was really in tight with the U.S. Defense Research Establishment. So he kind of knew everything, knew everybody. And in life, in 1946, after the war, based on all of his buddies in military intelligence, he reported that there was a 1945 model of the German rockets, that it was improved. It had a much greater range, so probably it was a larger rocket. And he says that, unfortunately, none of them fell into our hands. They were all captured by the Russians. And he goes on to explain that most of the major relevant production sites were captured by Soviet forces, not captured by the Americans. So here actually is a document from the Soviets. So these are specifications, blueprints on the left for the standard A4. For the A4 with wings, the A4B or the A9, and then for an A9 sitting on top of what was known as the A10, a booster first stage. So a much larger rocket, a two-stage rocket, this would have had range up to 5,000 kilometers. So this could have been launched from Germany and could have reached the United States or reached deep inside the Soviet Union. So here are captured Russian versions. And on the right, this is an original German version. This is from the Deutsches Museum Archive. Question is, was this simply a paper design for a large two-stage rocket, or did they build it? And there's quite a bit of evidence that they built this one as well. I won't drag you through this in detail. People who are curious can find all this on my website, read it at your leisure. But there are many, many sources reporting that they built these larger rockets. They were planning on launching these larger rockets. So wartime sources reporting that they have what was called a V4, which they could launch from Germany and reach the United States. And wartime U.S. officials that knew all about these rockets were very concerned that they'd be launched to the United States. And Albert Speer, German official, reporting that they expected to have these ready for firing against America very soon, as of late 1944. Here is a very interesting report. This is from the U.S. astronaut Gordon Cooper, one of the original Mercury 7, also a Gemini astronaut. And being a NASA astronaut, he was hanging out a lot with the German rocket engineers working at NASA. So hanging out with Wernher von Braun and with other engineers. And he said that according to the Germans, that at the end of World War II, there was, quote, a manned rocket sitting on the pad, all tested out, all fueled up, all ready to go. It was intended to drop a nuclear warhead on New York City. And that launch came within about a week of actually happening when the war ended. It's a quite dramatic testimony. And this is just, one of several examples of mentions of a pilot on this rocket. More examples here. There's so many sources, completely independent sources, very knowledgeable sources, and they are all singing the same hymn. They're all reporting the same story. So Walter Dornberger, the general who was in charge of the German rocket program, here is a biography of one of the Germans involved in the program. He came to work for the United States after the war. And a brief bit in the biography says, oh, yes, during the war, he was developing the guidance system for the A-10 two-stage rocket to hit the United States. Now, if it was just a paper project, if there was no two-stage rocket, why was he actually building the guidance system for it? So many other reports. This is another prisoner of war report. It's a captured German, a chemist from the Peenemünde rocket facility, who says, oh, yes, we have 18-meter rockets that we've been mass-producing, so 18 meters longer, we have the A-10, 23 meters longer, that has actually been built, at least in prototype form. Survivors from the concentration camps who were working on the rocket programs, and multiple survivors, multiple prisoners, reported overhearing Wernher von Braun and other officials talking about these large rockets to strike the United States. Still more evidence, still more information. The Navy Secretary Forrestal described these longer range rockets that were being mass produced or on the verge of being mass produced. The U.S. Army Ordnance Office, investigating after the war, described these very long range rockets that would have been used in the very near future if the war continued. The French investigators, as well as U.S. and Russian French investigators, described these rockets and said it was intended to launch the A-9 and A-10 to transport atomic bombs to the United States, and that this would have been a mass attack launched within just a few months if the war had continued. Still more evidence is actually from the U.S. War Department, now the U.S. Department of Defense. So their own press release from the U.S. War Department after the war said, oh, yes, we learned through our investigators after the war about the German, quote, experiments with the atomic bomb and experiments with piloted rocket missiles that could cross the Atlantic. So it mentions this, but doesn't actually provide the details. Now, for more details, here is a very interesting set of blueprints. And they came from this German rocket engineer, Heinz Stölzel. So I should mention his background. After the war, almost all of the German rocket engineers were scooped up by different countries, by the United States, by the Soviet Union, by the British, by the French, even a few elsewhere. So they were immediately put to work on super secret programs in those countries. And they kind of had to keep their mouths shut. Heinz Stölzel here escaped to Switzerland, and so he was able to blab more freely than the rest. Here he is in this photograph. This was taken in 1942 after the first successful test launch of the A-4, the V-2. So they're all being congratulated on their achievement. And in the back in a dark suit, this is Wernher von Braun grinning from ear to ear. Here's Walter Dornberger, the general in charge of the program. In the back, in the suit here, this is Heinz Stölzel, So he was part of this program to develop the A4 at Peenemünde. And then in the later years of the war, he was transferred to a facility in Thuringia in central Germany. And so here's an envelope from him. He was receiving mail at a fort in Thuringia. So he was working at some facility in Thuringia that was not the well-known Nordhausen Mittelbau facility. This was a different, even more secret facility. So he escaped Switzerland after the war, and he redrew his blueprints of what he'd been working on during the war. And then ultimately, his daughter immigrated to Australia. So these blueprints ended up in Australia, of all places. These blueprints show a piloted, a manned rocket. But if you look at it, it actually shows two pilots here. So not one, but two. And previously, I'd never seen anything like this. And I'd shown this to various experts. They'd never seen anything like this. Occasionally, you'll see a wartime dream of a rocket with one pilot, but not two. So it was very unusual, very strange. This is a longer version. This is 18 meters long, if you look at the math here. Was that just, some paper design, some pipe dream from Heinz Stölzl, or was it real? Here is an article from the New York Times from October 1944, so well before the end of the war. And this article is amazingly insightful. So the New York Times reporters were on the ground in Europe. They were talking to Allied officials, investigators, they used anonymous sources, but extremely well-informed sources. According to this New York Times article, Hitler had ordered the rocket program to shift from the standard A4 to building much larger, much more powerful rockets. And it describes these rockets as looking like an airplane in shape. In other words, these rockets had wings. So we're talking about the A9, and these rockets would be able to reach the United States. So we're talking about the A9 sitting on top of the A10. It says that, America will soon know what war is. But what is truly interesting, is that this report says the rocket would be controlled by humans. So not an automated guidance system, but controlled by humans. And it would carry, quote, two members of Heinrich Himmler's recently founded SS Air Force. So confirmation of the two-man rocket here. To tie into the nuclear question, this even describes the nuclear weapon that this rocket would carry and says that to trigger the nuclear weapon, electrical signals are sent both to the nuclear component, so in other words, a high voltage neutron initiator to initiate fission reactions at the center of the bomb, and simultaneously, electrical signals are sent to the conventional explosives, in other words, the conventional explosives surrounding the nuclear material to implode it. So this gives an amazingly detailed and accurate, declassified, unclassified version of the German, and for that matter, the American nuclear designs at the time. But yeah, two-man rocket here. And still more evidence. I was digging through NARA and found a bunch of documents in NARA in the archive at College Park. These were from the Army, the U.S. Army, in April 45. When they had captured and they were starting to investigate things in central Germany in Thuringia, and says, oh, by the way, we stumbled across this underground facility that is building something they call the V4, which has two pilots, a two-man rocket. So several different documents here describing mass production of the two-man rocket at an underground facility, which was not the better-known Nordhausen. And this underground facility was so large, it employed 20 to 30,000 workers, including a lot of French. These workers were all freed by the invading forces. They went back home, the French promptly blabbed to their local paper. Here is a French article about this facility building the V4 underground. Here's further confirmation this facility existed. So from a couple months later, from June of 45, here is a cover letter, talking about this underground facility, which was not Nordhausen. And yet all we have is this brief memo, this cover letter. We don't have the detailed reports on this facility. So those reports must exist. You know, the Allies were there, and yet the reports still seem to be classified to this day. So kind of think about the implications of all this. Here are massive German facilities during the war in 1944, 1945, that are mass producing a two-man spacecraft, something designed to carry two pilots into space. That would not be replicated until the 1960s for the Soviets with the Voskhod program and in the United States with the Gemini program. But here they were in 1944, 1945, being prepared to launch two astronauts into space. It's just mind-boggling. Or I don't even know if they'd call them astronauts. I mean, in the US, they're astronauts. In the Soviet Union, they were cosmonauts. I asked my wife what these should be called. If they're Germans, she suggested astronazis.
Oh no. Exactly.
Still more investigative reports. So this was from the US Navy investigating after the war, and they compiled over a 450-page report that still doesn't get into all the details. And it talks about very serious German work to develop the A9, A10, this two-stage rocket, and that this, you know, would have been completed if the war had not ended when it did. And it says, quote, "It is now obvious that the Germans realized and have accepted for years the fact that a controlled missile is the natural vehicle with which to transport atomic explosive." More prisoner of war reports. So this was a prisoner of war captured in early 1945, actually several different ones. And one of them reported that near Peenemünde, a little further east of Peenemünde, they were building not the standard V2s, not the standard A4s, but they were building and actually launching, testing a version that was 30 meters long. So that would be the full A9, A10. And that they were testing the explosive charge that would go on it, the very special explosive charge, and that even 1/25th of the explosive charge produced devastating results. So, say, like a kiloton instead of 25 kilotons. And then this report was, you know, confirmed, supported by other independent prisoner of war reports talking about the development of the nuclear weapons to, quote, destroy England in one blow and so forth. But the A9A10 was not the end of the line. It was not the largest rocket, believe it or not. There was something called an A11. So the A11 would be a very large first stage, with the A10 as the second stage, and then the A9 as the third stage, so a three-stage rocket. Boris Chertok, the Soviet official in charge of these captured German engineers after the war, said that, you know, the Soviet investigators learned that in 1941, Wernher von Braun and others gave a killer sales pitch to Hitler, and as a result, they got support at the highest level to work on the three-stage A9, A10, A11. And then after the war, when von Braun was in the United States, he was talking very proudly about this A9, A10, A11 rocket. And he said, yeah, we were developing these rockets to carry a 6-ton payload to the United States. So a 6-ton payload ties into that 6-ton bomb, the full-fledged German H-bomb, the largest of the three German nuclear weapons. Then he suddenly went very, very quiet in public after that. He never again talked about the 6-ton bomb and this large rocket that he was developing. But there must be, you know, detailed reports. You know, von Braun must have sat down with U.S. interrogators after the war and described all this in detail, or even turned over wartime German documents on these programs. There were other post-war Allied interrogators who found evidence of these larger rockets. So they described the A9, the A10, the A11, even all the way up to the A15. So, you know, here on the left, here on the table on the right, all the way up to the A15. They note that the A-15, however large that would be, probably never progressed beyond the drawing board stage. but they don't make the same caveat about the others. So it's a very open question, just how far did they get in building rockets that were just exactly how big? Those were rockets under Wernher von Braun's supervision during the war. There's evidence for a possibly completely different set of rockets. These were being developed and built in German-occupied Czech territory in Bohemia. And these were called the V3 or V4, but they were not necessarily the same thing as what von Braun and people had in mind for a V3 or V4. So we'll call them the Bohemian versions. After the war, many Allied investigators found evidence of these things. So a V4 rocket capable of being fired from Prague to the Americas with a nuclear payload being produced at plants in Czech territory, and that most of the relevant plants, the people, everything had all been captured after the war by the Soviets instead of the Americans. So these Allied investigators who were sneaking around found evidence of actually, quote, the completed V4. There was at least a completed prototype there. That prototype had a much longer range than standard German rockets, had a nose with, quote, a new and more powerful charge. I wonder what that could be. So all this was captured by the Russians. Here are other documents showing how much the Russians captured. This was somebody who escaped from the Russians to the West, but said, yeah, unfortunately, what the Russians got was all of the wartime German information on a long-range manned rocket bomb. So wartime programs on a manned rocket with very long range, and the Russians got this information. Here is another escaped person who said that, yeah, the Russians were having us rebuild wartime stuff that had basically twice the thrust, twice the propellant, twice the size of the standard V2, standard A4. Still more reports, all these different reports on the Soviet program, reporting that after the war, the Soviets were using not only the standard A4, but larger versions, including two-stage versions. So something called a V3, V4, they had two stages. They were larger than the standard A4. These rockets are similar to the German V-type, but larger in size. Reconstructing the wartime A4, reconstructing the wartime A9, reconstructing something called the wartime G2, which is virtually unheard of in other documents. Still more information on the post-war Soviet program. Prisoners who escaped and describing that the Soviets after the war had apparently captured German rockets that weighed 40 tons, so much, much larger than a standard A4. They were doing experiments with piloted versions of these that hold two pilots, so a two-man crew coming back to the two-man rocket. So many different independent sources of evidence all saying the same thing. Talking about the A8, which you've seen before, stretched A4, and a range able to reach the United States, greatly improved accuracy for these rockets as well. Here is a very impressive report that came out of the Soviet Union. This is from a witness or multiple witnesses who actually saw captured German rockets in the Soviet Union. They say that the rockets were approximately 40 to 45 meters in length. That is much larger even than the A9, A10. If these bits of information are correct, then this would be something like an A9, A10, A11 prototype that had been built during the war, captured by the Soviets and undergoing test by the Soviets after the war. And says that the Soviets found a lot of the stuff at Arnstadt in Thuringia, one of several large rocket facilities. Clearly, there's all this evidence that the Germans were building these large rockets during the war. So what did they plan to do with them? We can actually read their own documents, their own blueprints, and see what they had in mind for a purpose. This is from Heinz Stölzl, again, who escaped after the war. And so here are, along with his rocket designs, these are graphs of the planned trajectory for the rocket, showing it'd be launched from Germany. It would go up, first stage, second stage, and then come back down. And thanks to its wings, it would go on a gliding reentry, kind of like the space shuttle, and end up in New York City and see the sights on Broadway. And over here on the left, this is from the Deutsches Museum. It's a wartime document, which shows a tourist map of New York City. Here's Manhattan here, with this giant bullseye on it, you know, showing the expected, you know, blast range of this thing once it hits Manhattan. So we have information from so many sources, all saying the same thing. For example, many different German officials who were very high ranking, very much in a position to know, all said that the large rockets were actually built. So we have information from Hitler's inner circle that they were building these things. They planned to launch them at the U.S. to, quote, make the USA amenable to peace. From Otto Skorzeny in the SS, that by March 1945, they had built a rocket capable of bombarding New York or Moscow. And from Heinrich Himmler's Adjutant Werner Grotman, that they had built prototype giant rockets during the war. So at the end of the war, Hitler's inner circle was contemplating whether they should use their prototype rockets and their prototype nuclear weapons and launch a desperate strike. And of course, they never did. But that is from German officials. Same story, different verse from Allied wartime intelligence from people who knew. Wartime intelligence reporting that we very quickly learned that there was a rocket with a weight of 68 tons, much, much larger than a standard A4. And, you know, they were building enough of these things that Allied intelligence very quickly and easily learned this. Again, the reports about rockets so large, they required three railroad cars just to carry one rocket. This is a very high-level U.S. report from early 1945 saying that larger rockets are known to exist, rockets with a length up to 68 feet, as opposed to the standard 45 feet for conventional A4 or V2. So all these wartime intelligence things reporting the same thing. All of the Allied political leaders in a position to know reporting the same thing. The large rockets were actually built. Here is from Winston Churchill, who is not really known for, you know, fluffing up the Germans. So after the war, you know, he reported that we just barely won the war in time. He has, you know, seen and had reports of exactly what kind of weapons Germany had in store for Great Britain if the war had continued any further. This is from a U.S. senator saying that he has personally visited some of these German facilities with investigators after the war. And so with his own eyes, he has seen these more advanced rockets. And he knows that, you know, they were ready or almost ready when the war ended. Here's a different U.S. senator who's also visited the same facilities and also reports he's personally seen these super rockets that would have struck New York if the war had continued. So many different sources. Here are Allied military leaders. So General Karl Spatz reporting, yeah, the Germans were readying a transatlantic model of the rocket when the war ended. General Henry Arnold in the Army Air Forces, the A-10, a very large rocket intended especially for New York, was being built. And another one of these press releases that at the end of the war, you know, they were mass producing or scaling up for mass production of these rockets able to strike the United States. From Colonel, later General Donald Putt in the U.S. Army Air Forces, it wasn't until we got investigators there on the ground we discovered these advanced rockets. So the same story from all these sources, you know, both the German sources and the Allied sources. And they're saying that these rockets had reached at least the prototype stage, that they were being mass-produced or on the verge of being mass-produced. And that's very different than the usual story in the history books, which is that these larger rockets were just purely a paper design. So the people who've seen them with their own eyes know it was not a paper design. And of course, in fact, it would take many years from a paper design to a finished functional rocket. It took many years to get that far with the A4, and both the Germans and the Allied investigators would know it would take several years to go from a paper design to a working rocket for these larger versions. So if they were this concerned that larger versions were ready or almost ready, this was clearly much more than just a paper design. More from U.S. General Henry Arnold. In a communication to Carl Spatz during the war, 1944, he expresses concern. We must prevent these known large German rockets from ever causing damage to the U.S. He was concerned that these large 75-ton rockets, these known 75-ton rockets, would land in England or the United States, and they must do everything to prevent that. Still more reports. Once U.S. forces invaded France, they started finding evidence of a lot of this in person, formerly German-occupied sites, and they found evidence for German rockets designed to carry a payload with a blast radius of 3 kilometers, 2 miles. So clearly, some kind of nuclear weapon payload. This is from Colonel George Woods, who after the war went on became Assistant Undersecretary of the Air Force. He says, yeah, all of us intelligence folks during the war knew about Germany's plans for the A9 armed with an atomic bomb destined for New York City. We knew that Germany had hoped to have that ready by the end of 1944, and they were only delayed as long as they were by all the Allied bombing by the invasion of Normandy. More information from Donald Putt. It's well known how far these programs were, it's a matter of conjecture just how soon Germany would have launched this massive strike with multiple nuclear weapons, multiple rockets, if the war had continued even just a few more days or weeks. Other information. This is from U.S. General Thomas Betts from one of the chief British science advisors, Sir Reginald Patrick Linstead. So after the war, they were in charge of this Chios investigative committee that sent hundreds, thousands of investigators all over German territory looking at these programs. At the very end of the Chios investigation, these two leaders of Chios wrote their own final report for the Chios investigations. They say that their investigators on the ground have found conclusive evidence for versions of the A9 with a range of 2,400 miles, able to reach New York City. This would be the A9, A10. They had found evidence for versions with greatly improved guidance systems, with accuracy down to 150 feet, so much more accurate than most of the V2s that were launched against London, for example. They had found evidence that experiments had already been conducted on piloted models. So they not only built those piloted versions, they had launched those piloted versions. They had test launched them. Then of particular significance were the statements by high German experts that they planned to use these rockets to carry their atomic explosives. Even that some of the atomic explosives they had in mind had a mass of less than 1 ton. So they'd be talking about the smallest of the three nuclear designs, about 300 kilograms or so. So it's interesting that, all these people in the know would make these statements, all these generals, all these leading political figures. They're not just making stuff up in public. They're speaking based on detailed, very confident information that they have. And yet we don't have those detailed reports. Those detailed reports must exist, but they are still buried and classified someplace in the archives. Here's yet another general speaking up. This is General William Richardson, who was in charge of Army Air Force's guided missiles after the war. And he says, yeah, during the war, the Germans were, working on the A9, A10 rocket to strike the United States. And we have evidence that they planned to put their atomic warhead on top of it. So this general has evidence. He was confident enough to say that to the press in 1947. But we don't have his evidence. His evidence is still classified and missing. Still more evidence. This is part of a train log, so a logbook of shipments arriving by train in Austria in 1944 and 1945. And what's interesting is that many of these shipments were received by the German SS General Hans Kammler. And in the later years of the war, he came to control virtually all of these very advanced weapons programs in Germany, both the rockets and the nuclear weapons. So he was personally signing for shipments he received. And among the shipments he received was a shipment of 18-meter-long machines. Now, I don't think these are 18-meter-long bulldozers or anything he was signing for. I think these were 18-meter-long rockets. These were extended A4 rockets or A9 rockets he was signing for. And we don't have to wonder about this. We know what he was signing for. At least somebody knows what he was signing for. Because officially, he died at the end of the war in early May 45. And yet, we have a number of rediscovered U.S. archival documents indicating that, you know, even many, many months after the war, he was alive and well and in U.S. custody and singing like a canary. So somebody, someplace in U.S. archives has all of his post-war interrogations, reports, describing exactly what these 18-meter-long machines were, exactly what the German nuclear weapons were. Likewise, Wernher von Braun, who you know was the chief designer for these rockets, would have been in a position to know. And he talked about the very special 6-ton payload he had in mind for his rockets. And so it's interesting when you go looking at the U.S. National Archive for Wernher von Braun's paperclip file, there are detailed paperclip files on you know many, many hundreds of other German scientists and engineers who came to the United States after the war. But if you look in these files, look in their directory for Wernher von Braun, he's missing. There is no paperclip file for Wernher von Braun, our very most famous paperclip scientist. And he must have a paperclip file. And yet it is not at NARA, or at least it's not listed at NARA. They even have his brother here, Magnus von Braun, but they don't have him. So he must have a paperclip file. It must make for very juicy reading. But it is not available to the public. Other examples of withheld documents. On the left is a document from the U.S. Air Force Archive. This is a cover letter talking about a report by captured German rocket engineers describing their work on, quote, large-sized rockets and applications for large-sized rockets. Gee, what can you do with a large-sized rocket? So here's the cover letter. But we don't have the report. The report is still classified and withheld. Here on the right, this is a card catalog. This card catalog has index cards for reports, including a report written in 1947, so a couple of years after the war. It's written by the CIG, which was kind of an intermediate state between the wartime OSS and the post-war CIA. And it is the complete history of German transatlantic rocket A-10, classified top secret. So you know, it exists. We have the card catalog entry for it, but we don't have the report itself. And man, that would make one heck of a coffee table book if you could actually find that thing. Still more information. You know, there's so many withdrawal slips and things for these reports, so we know that these reports exist. But when you go to request the report, the NARA people will hand you something saying, no soup for you, access restricted, this document has been withdrawn. So if these programs didn't exist, why are there all these reports about the programs? And why are the reports still classified here 80 years later? You know, there must be something really interesting in those reports. So to summarize this portion of the presentation, there's a lot more to learn about exactly how far the German engineers got during the war. But what we do know is that the German engineers and their technology then after the war came to the United States and, of course, developed their technology all the way to the Saturn V. So here's Wernher von Braun and his buddies. And a separate group of German engineers were captured by the Soviet Union. Went on and produced the missiles and the space rockets for the Soviet Union. There were some who were captured by the UK produced the post-war rocket and missile programs for the UK. There were a bunch who are less well known publicly, but they were captured by the French and produced the post-war French rockets and missiles. Here's Karl-Heinz Bringer, for example. So this became the modern French and European Ariane rockets. So there's more to be learned, not only about the wartime programs, but there's more to be learned about exactly what contributions were made after the war by these people. Some of this is not as publicly known as it should be. So in addition to the liquid propellant missiles, there were also liquid propellant space planes. So let's talk about those. You've already seen the winged A9. This was even better. This was called the Silverbird, or Silbervogel in German, suborbital bomber. Right? Nice, catchy name. They started working on this in 1933, very seriously, and continued all the way up to the very end of the war in 45. This was the brainchild of kind of the Austrian version of Werner von Braun, named Eugen Zenger, his wife, or later wife, Irene Brett. And so they designed what is basically a mini space shuttle. This would carry a pilot to guide it. It would carry a payload, it would be launched from Germany. They were showing that these things could go potentially any place on the planet, drop their payload off any place on the planet. Just like the A9 had the A10 for a first stage, this would be launched by a first stage. Except the first stage was actually a rocket sled, so a very large rocket designed as a sled-type contraption on rails, that first stage would stay on the rails use up all of its propellant and give a very large boost to this mini space shuttle, which would be the second stage, and then had its own engine that would carry it up into space. So if you read the books, this is mentioned quite a bit in various history books and space books, but everybody says, oh, this was just a paper design. This was clearly so crazy. It was just a paper design. They could never do this. They could never get permission to do this. Purely a paper design. If it was purely a paper design, why do we have a photograph of its rocket engine? This is a photograph from the Deutsches Museum of this 100-ton thrust Silbervogel rocket engine in 1941. 4 years before the war ended. How far did they get by 1945? We have reports from post-war investigators, in this case, Canadian investigators, who went to tour all the German rocket facilities after the war and said how impressed they were to see a rocket motor that was 10 times larger than the standard V2 or A4 rocket motor. That sounds like this thing. So they were making these giant, giant rocket engines. For something like the Silbervogel, the Silverbird. Still more reports. Once France was invaded by the Allies, they started finding more and more information about what Germany was building there on occupied territory, including this giant launch ramp, these rails I described. Were intended, according to the French people who are around, to launch these winged rockets and strike the United States. So intended to launch the Silbervogel. They're actually building the launch site, building the rails. Moreover, they added, the Germans had very helpfully told them, by the way, when we launch this thing, make sure you stand back 6 miles in case it accidentally detonates on the launch pad. So it was carrying a weapon with a blast radius of 6 miles. That is much more than a standard fission bomb. That is an H-bomb blast radius corresponding to the 6-ton bomb. So they were planning to launch the 6-ton bomb. They were working on the 6-ton bomb. They were building the launch ramps. They were building the engines for this thing. According to multiple sources, they were actually building the Silbervogel. So from reporters, Colonel, later General Donald Putt, they were building it. And so Putt, who led many Allied investigators after the war, captured many of these German engineers, was definitely in a position to know. He wrote in a journal, that they'd built, the Germans had built a test version of this that carried one man and had landing gear. Test runs were made on the engine. And Putt was left wondering if they'd maybe even test launch this thing. He wasn't sure whether or not they'd actually test launch this thing, but they had built this. More information on that 6-ton bomb. This is from the designers themselves of that rocket, so Eugen Zenger and Irena Bratt. And so they wrote up a report with their calculations showing how their winged gizmo could be used for an attack on New York with a bomb load of 6 tons. Now, they were Austrian. They were doing a lot of this work in Austria. Here is another document from Austrian scientists. There was a very large Austrian group that was developing nuclear weapons during the war. It was led by a professor named Georg Stetter. So this is from someone who was very well acquainted with Stetter and the other people in his research group. And so after the war, he wrote, you know, it'd be really quite a shame if somebody were to set off a 6-ton bomb that has lithium hydride or lithium deuteride fusion fuel and has a fission bomb with uranium or plutonium to light the fusion fuel. It'd be quite a shame if somebody were to set off a 6-ton bomb like that overhead over some country. So, gee, what could they have had in mind for their 6-ton payload here?
Todd, that's amazing. That describes exactly what eventually became the thermonuclear weapons of
Yes,
today.
exactly. Exactly. And indeed, there are a number of documents from the war or from investigators immediately after the war describing wartime German work on nuclear weapons using lithium hydride or lithium deuteride. Of course, after the war, Oak Ridge shifted and started doing isotope separation of lithium for lithium deuteride, just like that. In fact, there are documents during the war about German isotope separation of lithium during the war. They were separating lithium 6 and lithium 7 during the war. So this was much more than just a paper design. They had a very serious H-bomb program. And according to multiple sources, they got within perhaps several months of actually testing their H-bomb. So they were doing exactly what Oak Ridge, what so many people in the United States and the Soviet Union did after the war. But the US and the Soviet Union perfected that in the 1950s. And here was Germany on the verge of perfecting it in 1945. Of course, the US and the Soviet Union didn't have methods of delivering those H-bombs until the 1950s. But here is Germany, perfecting or on the verge of perfecting delivery methods during the war. Even these two-man rockets, even a two-man spacecraft to carry this thing.
That's amazing. And is there evidence? You mentioned the lithium work. Is there evidence of where that was being done?
That is a
And
great.
about the uranium and plutonium, evidence of that separation?
That is a great question. There are a number of post-war Allied reports, investigating all these sites, and Germany was mass producing lithium. I mean, they were making thousands of tons of lithium during the war, and of course, some of that could be for non-nuclear applications, but it's available for nuclear applications as well. There are reports from the scientist who perfected their isotope separation method for the lithium, perfected a method of separating lithium 6 and lithium 7. And it's not clear if they actually scaled that up or not. For the production, it's lithium deuterides. So you need the deuterium as well. Deuterium, a part of heavy water, as everybody knows, was being produced in Norway at a site called Fum. Everybody's familiar with that one. Everybody's seen the movie. What people are not familiar with is that there were over two dozen other sites that were mass producing deuterium, mass producing heavy war. So all over German occupied Europe, they had, according to my current count, about 27 or 28 plants making deuterium. They were mass producing deuterium. They were mass producing lithium. For the uranium 235 or the plutonium, I have a lot of documents, hundreds of pages of documents about that. Rather than building one Oak Ridge, and Oak Ridge is an amazing facility, but if Germany had tried to build one Oak Ridge, Then they might as well paint a giant bullseye on it. There'd be Allied bombers overhead, and that'd be the end of the German Oak Ridge. So with all of the late wartime production, Germany did, their production of this, their production of that, not in one central place that could be bombed, but they distributed it. They did, part of it here, part of it there, part of it there. And many of those sites were underground, practically invulnerable to the site, types of bombs they had. So most of their wartime production was distributed and underground. And one would certainly expect them to do that with something very sensitive like a nuclear program.
Right, I agree. Well, we're going to have to transition here, and I'm thinking now that you need some more time to even finish this segment up, and we'll do that on the next time. But I have one specific question before we leave,
Sure.
a lithium issue, and that is there any evidence that they use mercury in separating that lithium?
That is a good question. They were using mercury for other applications. I know that Oak Ridge used mercury for its lithium preparation. The method that I mentioned, so the known wartime German method of separating was electrolysis in salts. It did not use mercury. But they may have had a separate mercury process for it. So it's an open question.
I understand. I do. And again, I apologize for having to ask you to cut this out
Sure.
at the point, but we're just running completely out of time.
Certainly.
Would it be best if we come back on the next time, if you sort of brought us up to here and finished this one out and then went on into the other part?
Certainly, we can do that. But just to summarize this, there are so many different sources of evidence, all telling a part of the same story. This is not in the conventional history books, but it is there in the archives. And so I'm hoping to encourage other people to go digging in the archives, find even more than I have. For folks living in Europe, maybe even go digging in the ground very, very carefully, look for evidence for some of this stuff. Very good.
Outstanding. Thank you so much. Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.